simulate a quantum metal body.
Okay, so this is work done jointly with Frank Verstappen and also with Sebastian Sivak. And so the thing is that, well, one of the big problems of quantum mechanics, especially like in solid state physics, quantum chemistry, and so on, is to simulate quantum many body systems. So we have quantum many body systems. And well, you want to simulate them. And this is a difficult task simply because many body systems will have complicated exponentially sized filled space, infinite dimensional wave function, whatever. So the complexity of this kind of the systems is huge, it's growing enormously quickly. And of course, people have come up with algorithms to do that. And well, in this talk, we'll certainly talk about density function theory. And if there's some time at the end, I might also talk about the density matrix renormalization group. And there are, of course, a lot of other actually very successful algorithms. The other thing is that recently, with the advent of quantum complexity theory, quantum information theory, people have realized that describing problems of quantum many body systems can indeed be classified in terms of computational complexity, difficulty. So complexity theory can help you assess questions concerning quantum many body systems and understand why they're difficult and how they're related to other difficult questions. And what I will try to show you in this talk, how these two things can interact, namely how we can see that complexity theory tells us something about limitations to certain simulation algorithms, simulation methods. And well, that's kind of the negative aspect. You cannot do certain things with these algorithms. But it also tells you what you have to look for if you want these algorithms to work. Or more specific, most of these algorithms work in the physical scenarios. But typically, there are no proofs that they work under specific conditions. It's just people know that they work under specific conditions. And so this also tells you what kind of things you have to require on your system in order to maybe be able to prove that some algorithm will work. OK, so that's the general motivation. So I will talk about density function theory. And if there's some time at the end, I might say something about the results on the density matrix normalization group. Okay, so
basically, you want to probe when DFT, for example, does not converge.
Exactly, that's kind of the negative perspective is that you say, look, we're the bad guys to tell you when it doesn't work. Okay. But it has kind of a positive component because it tells you that if you want to have a general picture where you can really show that the method works, okay, you will have to put some more requirements than we put in our proof, in our construction, where we show that it doesn't work in certain situations.
So you go deeply to analyze, the algorithm itself and not say, oh, if this problem is complicated, then DFT shouldn't be able to simulate it.
Well, kind of, but we go more into the algorithm and we pinpoint, okay, here that's at this place in the algorithm, there's a problem to solve, a problem to assess, which is, in general, a complicated problem. Okay, so if I talk about something without explaining it, you should stop me, because when I prepared this talk, I realized that I didn't plan to introduce quantum complexity classes. So then I realized that some people might not be that familiar with QMA as I might be. Okay, so density function theory. So actually, one thing about this work about density function theory that I realized that, in fact, density function theory is the basic idea is very easy to understand. So if I'm fast stopping because it's very nice to understand it and it's not so difficult. Yeah. Okay, so what we want to simulate with density function theory is actually one of the big things in solid state physics, but also especially in theoretical chemistry, in quantum chemistry. It's a system of n electrons in an external potential. So this is what you get if you say have a molecule and you fix a position, you do the Born Oppenheimer approximation, you fix a position of the nuclei, and then you can compute the energy of this electronic configuration plus the energy of the nuclei, and that way you can do minimization and figure out what the geometry of the molecule should be. That's the way it's typically done. So what you want to do is that you have to do this optimization given the potential of the nuclei, what is the minimal energy configuration of the electrons. So what you want to know is the ground state energy. So in the following, whenever I talk about the difficulty of a problem, it's always finding the ground state energy of the problem, up to some accuracy. Okay, so, well, what do we have? We have Hamiltonian for n electrons, which is something like kinetic energy term. Well, a Coulomb term. And then we have an external potential, which might be an electrostatic potential, but it might also contain a magnetic term which causes the spin degree of freedom of the electron. So that's why I write an X and not an R, actually. Okay, so let's label these guys because we will need them later. That's a kinetic energy P. That's the interaction energy. And this I call B again. So we have three contributions in this Hamiltonian. And what we want to know is the ground state energy. So what is that? That is the minimum of all omega, where omega is an antisymmetric n electron density function. Density matrix. So one of the things which makes this complicated is, of course, that we have to optimize not over all states, but actually only over the antisymmetric states. So we have to minimize almost all these antisymmetric functions of, well, something like mathematically the trace of t plus I plus v omega. Okay, so now the first thing is that one can take this minimization and rewrite it as two nested minimizations.
Sorry, you're saying that's you're using h for that? That's the
sorry, it's my fault. Okay. So that's the zero of h, or actually of v, whatever. Let's leave this open for the moment.
So why is this an asterisk? Is that
oh, because it's electrons. So electrons are described by antisymmetric wave functions. Which is something which probably makes the problem harder. It should be easier with symmetric wave functions. So if you don't have these functions. Okay, so now the point. So that's not what I presented is not the original perspective of density function theory, but it's a very appealing and simple perspective which has been developed in the 80s by Ebers and other people. So the idea is to nest the minimization the following way. Namely, we optimize over all densities of a single electron. So we take all the n electrons and we trace out all but one. Doesn't matter which one we choose because of the antisymmetry. So we get the density of electrons. So we optimize over a fixed, we minimize over all possible densities of electrons. And within this minimization, we minimize over all global states, which give rise to this reduced density of a single electron.
So you minimize over pure states?
Well, actually, we do over all states. You could do it over pure states, and actually, it will influence the final result. You should amend me later. If I forget, then I can make a comment on that.
So you want to make a compatibility?
But you can, sorry?
You
want? So
the requirement is to make it compatible.
Sorry?
I want to make things compatible. Or what?
There's a representability problem here too.
It's related to the point that, of course, so the point is the following: this omega depends on like
right.
And what you do is you integrate out, well, there's a delta function starting from L to R2. You integrate out all but 1 degree of freedom, so you get something like rho R1 prime. And, well, in principle, you should also pack a spin degree of freedom into that. But you trace out all but one particle. It doesn't matter which one because they're distinguishable. And then what you do is, instead of just saying you optimize on all these wave functions, you say, let's fix some density and optimize on all wave functions, which give rise to some density. And then we optimize on all densities. And the point is, because it's a single electron density, there's no issue with the n representability problem, because single electron wave functions are essentially all n representable. So to any the electron density, there exists a global state which represents it, except for very singular ones, like if you have a delta at one side. OK, so you still have the same minimization. Let me group them into parts. So we have the kinetic and the interaction part. And we have the potential energy part. And now the following thing happens, that the potential is something which only couples to the density of the electrons. So the spin polarized density, but still the density of the electrons go. So this part actually is not involved in this minimization. So again, OK. Do I manage to cope with the Maxwell system? So again, we can rewrite this as a minimum over density. And then, well, let's call this f of rho, which is a minimization. Plus, the potential energy part. So you see the ground state energy can be written as a sum of two contributions, which only depend on the density. But however, the nice thing is, what does different problems make different? How can you distinguish different molecules? Well, they're just distinguished by the external potential they induce. So the kinetic part and the interaction part of the Hamiltonian are the same for any problem of interacting electrons you look at. So it turns out that this part here, of the whole thing, doesn't depend on the problem you look at. It's the same for all kinds of problems you're trying to solve. And this is the only part which really defines your problem. And so essentially, that's a curve density factor theory, that you say, OK, there's a problem. So this minimization is of a single particle density. So essentially, it's a one-particle problem. It should be much simpler than optimizing the complicated n-particle problem. On the other hand, there's still something contained which encodes this many-body optimization problem. However, this part is universal. It doesn't depend on the problem you look at. So if you think really hard and come up with some function or some approximation to this function, which is accurate enough, you can solve all problems much more efficiently because they all reduce to a single particle problem. Is this clear enough? So this is what is called typically like universal functional.
Can you repeat why it is that the term involving the potential depends only on single electron?
Oh, because the external potential couples only to individual electrons. Right? So yeah, in your Hamiltonian, you have a kinetic part, this has some derivatives, so it might not only depend on the density, but also the phase decay of freedom in the density. Well, there's a Coulomb interaction, which obviously depends on the two particle induced state and not on the single particle state. And then you have a potential energy, but this really only couples to individual electrons. So if you trace out, it just couples to the density. Well, it's spin density in principle if you have a magnetic field, but still.
Okay.
It only couples to individual particles. And so in the end, the surprising insight is that, or well, the nice insight which leads to density function theory is the following, that in your Hamiltonian, you have two types of terms. You have terms which only depend on the density, and terms which are completely independent of the problem you consider. So everything which is problem dependent only depends on the density. And that is why you can't really express it as a single part of the problem. And so actually, the big thing in density function theory is to come up with good approximations to this function. And that's why people have developed a lot of techniques to do this. And, well, sometimes they put some information about the problem into it, although it's supposed to be problem independent, because then you can make a more accurate function. And in fact, it's a highly successful field. And so what we wondered is, are there some kind of limitations how well you can approximate this function, how well you can describe this functional, based on the observation that it seemingly reduces a very complicated problem to a much simpler problem. And that's what I would like to talk about. Let's see. Did I miss anything before?
So, I'm sorry. In general, I mean, when you work here, the universal function, right? I mean, minimizing that is very hard. It's many particles. You know, we don't know how to solve
them. Yes.
Yes. Are you considering a lattice behind this or
something? No, no, that's the function. Theory people wouldn't consider a lattice. They, this would be like a integral or something. Or
I see. Are you going to do some approximation?
It depends. I mean, I guess in DFT you would typically choose a basis set and solve within this basis set, and then again. Five dimensional space.
Are you going to do some approximation to the potential? I mean, the.
Oh, I will tell you immediately how I will do it. Let's choose a different board. Let me say a few sentences, maybe.
Because I mean, since start, right? Even if B is equal to zero, it's a complicated problem. We may not have to solve it.
Oh, yes. Wait. I mean, the whole thing is, if you set B to zero, what to solve? You mean for a fixed role? No. The constant energy for B equal to zero.
Oh, right. If you have a bunch of electrons, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we don't even know how to solve that.
Without constant potential. But yeah. Well, it depends which question you ask. I mean, here you just ask for the ground state energy. So then it should be kind of simple because it's just a single number, right? You might have to think hard to come up with this number, but it's a hard problem, but you can't assess it with tools of computational complexity because it's just like finding a single number. That's solving a class of problems. This is again more like solving a class of problems somehow because this row, of course, can again encode a lot of information. And that's of course like why it's still hard, because somehow although it's problem independent, it can cause a solution to a lot of problems. Okay, so the idea to do this is the following, that we look at the Hubble model. I will tell you in a minute more about it. Okay, we had some weird diagram. Okay, so the point is that the Hubble model arises as a special case of a system of interacting electrons. And actually that's part of our proof that this can be done rigorously, because typically this is more like a phenomenological derivation that people do. And the other thing we do is that we show that solving the Hubble model, so finding the ground state of the Hubble model, is, well, I have to introduce quantum complexity classes in a minute, is actually complete for a class which is called QMA. So these are the problems which are hard to solve even by a quantum computer, but well, you can at least verify the solution using a quantum computer. And then, well, we take the fact that it's a special, so we merge the Hubble model with the fact that it's a special case of interacting electrons, and we use density function theory to try to solve the Hubble model. And if we assume we have this functional, or a good approximation to the functional, what we actually can show is that it can be solved efficiently. Which means that, well, computing this functional is essentially a QMA hard problem under Turing deductions, by the way. So maybe this answers your question partly. So the way we assess it, we restrict the subspace.
Do you have a lattice now in mind?
Because yes, the Hubble model is I will introduce it in a minute. It's a lattice model, and we solve it on that lattice model.
I see. Okay, that's fine.
So in the end, we go to a lattice. But the thing is that, I mean, all this QMA is defined in spins without statistics. So I mean, from this continuous model, you have to go to a lattice model, and you have to get rid of this anti-symmetry of the wave function or of the state. So you have to go to spin system. The other thing is that density function theory doesn't apply to lattice models. There are lattice versions of density function theory, but they typically behave differently. So that's why we indeed show how you can embed the Hubble model rigorously into a system of interacting electrons with some strong potential. And then you can indeed show that if you apply density function theory to it, you can solve it efficiently.
That is one spatial dimension or something?
Sorry? Oh, the Hubble model is in two dimensions, actually.
The Hubble model in two dimensions is not known about this model.
Oh, yes, exactly. That's what I wanted to say. But it's not known about the solid exactly, right? But what can quantify is a half computation
process. That's okay. Okay, I see.
So I just want to approximate the ground state energy, and I want to show it's a hard problem. I want to quantify the hardness of that problem.
So is the result that finding the ground state of the Hubble model is QMA complete, that's a result of this work?
Yes.
Okay.
That's one result. And the other result is to show that using DFT becomes much simpler. Okay, I guess I should introduce some complexity classes briefly. Okay. So the point in complexity theory is that people would typically focus on decision problems, so asking yes, no questions, simply because it makes things much easier to assess, because it's only yes or no and not like an infinite amount of numbers, which you get as an outcome. So we would ask questions like, can this graph be colored with three colors? And the answer would be yes or no. The answer would not be some specific coloring. So you can introduce some classes like P, which is, well, can be computed in polynomial time. Or, well, the other program classic class would be NP, which is like actually coloring of graphs, which is the following. If the answer is yes, it means that there exists a proof which can be checked efficiently. So like coloring of graphs with three colors. If the answer is yes, you can color it. You can just give a coloring, you can check it, you can verify it's a valid coloring. And well, there are two quantum complexity classes which are very important, which is BQP, which is like P with quantum. Just trying to read this. So it's like everything which can be solved by a quantum computer in polynomial time. And then there's an important class for our work, which is QMA, which is means quantum Merlin Arthur, which is like essentially a quantum version of NP. So the point of it is, so if the answer to the question is yes, it means there's a quantum state which serves as a proof for the fact that it's yes, which can be checked efficiently by a quantum computer. But typically quantum computers won't give deterministic outcomes. That's why actually it's not NP but MA, which means it's probabilistic. And the typical problem would actually, not surprisingly, looking back, I'm not surprised it's connected. The typical problem for QMA is given some local Hamiltonian, you ask, is the ground state energy of the Hamiltonian below some value A? Well, or above some value B, where B minus A is not too small. So I mean, colloquially speaking, it means like, what is the ground state energy up to some polynomial accuracy? That's the idea behind. But to face the decision problem, you just set the threshold somewhere and say, well, let's forget about this polynomial gap, which is our accuracy, is it below or not? And the proof in that case would just be the ground state. Because if you have a ground state and you have a local Hamiltonian, one can show it's possible to take these local terms, measure them, and estimate their energy up to some polynomial accuracy in polynomial time. And well, if there's no such state, you cannot fool a verifier. And the big thing actually is to show that this is among the hardest problems of this class. So Kipharik has done this.
Okay. So I have two questions now. I mean, that assumption of a ground state, you assume you have many copies of the state?
It depends how you define this class QMA, but yes, you could provide many copies of the ground state. The point would be that you say, okay, the proof shouldn't be too large. It should only have polynomial size in the problem I'm looking at. But if you provide one copy or a polynomial number of copies, that doesn't really make a difference.
And the other question is, saying finding the ground state is QMA complete. Do you have some representation for the ground state?
Oh, well, no, the thing that you say, all these complexity classes are in some sense classic. You ask a classical question, you get a classical answer. Just in the way they are defined, I mean, QMA is defined in such a way that if the answer to your classically posed question, which is your Hamiltonian, is yes, you can provide a state.
Okay.
Which really, if you have you get this quantum state, you have a quantum computer, you can check that the answer is yes.
Oh,
so it's not in the definition of the class, but and in that case, I mean, it's a spin Hamiltonian. It's defined as spin, so statistically spin qubit Hamiltonians, if you want. So we just take these guys and then do measurements of these guys with a normal fine computing picture. Okay. So the Hubbard model. So this denotes nearest neighbors on the 2D lattice. So this is a spin. What else do we need? We need an on-cycle torsion. So the Hubbard Hamiltonian is a lattice, 2D lattice Hamiltonian in that case, where we have some kind of particles sitting in localized modes, particles with spin, say electrons. And one thing is they can hop around between nearest neighbors on the lattice. Another thing is that if you have two of them at one lattice side, first of all, they need to have different spins. You can only have one particle of one spin per side. And you have an on-cycle repulsion. So if you have two particles, two electrons at the same side, they have some Coulomb repulsion. So they have a much higher energy or higher energy depending on the scales. And well, we still have this spin. So let's say this is a spin operator at some side. Okay. So the intuition really, I will say a bit more about this later, is that you have some lattice. And in this lattice, you have your electrons. And these electrons can hop around. They can tunnel through the wells. And the thing is such that your second excited mode, so this is like the energy of that state, but if you want to put a second electron of the same spin somewhere here, the next one will have such a high energy that it's not a bound state anymore. Or at least it has such a high energy that it will not appear in practice. Well, and the other thing is, of course, if you have opposite spins, you can put two electrons on one side, but they will get a much higher energy because they're very close to each other, and the Coulomb term will pedal like this. Oh, time's moving fast. Okay, so the thing we want to show is that finding the ground state energy of this Hubbard model is QMA complete. So to this end, one has to show two things. Namely, one thing is to show it's inside QMA. Now, actually, this is not so difficult because what you can do is you can do a Jordan-Wigner transformation, which map these fermionic creation annihilation operators to spin creation annihilation operators. And of course, the Hamiltonian you get then is not local anymore. So you can provide the ground state in the state of spins, clearly, but it's not a local Hamiltonian. So the question is, can you still check the ground state energy efficiently? It turns out you can, because a non-local part has a very simple structure. It's just a local operator here, a local operator there, and you have a product of Pauli Z operators, which come from the Jordan-Wigner transformation. And for these operators, you can still efficiently measure their energy in some state. So the easy part, and actually the part which is also not important for our proof in the end, because we want to show it's a hard problem.
You mentioned that you are considering 2D lattice, right?
Sorry?
You're considering 2D lattice.
Yes.
And for this case, Jordan-Wigner transformation is much more complicated.
No. You do the standard 1D Jordan-Wigner transformation on the 2D lattice. And you pose some 1D order in the lattice. So that's why I'm saying that we don't end up with a local Hamiltonian after the Jordan-Wigner transformation.
Okay.
But you end up with a Hamiltonian which has a form like. So you have your 1D order, you have some lattice sites here where you have, I don't know, say sigma plus, you have the Hopping operator. Then you have sigma z, sigma z, and so on. Let's say your 1D ordering goes like that. Sigma z, and then you have sigma minus. This is a Hopping operator from here to here. So it's not a local operator anymore, but if you want to show it's a problem in QMA, what you want to show is, well, you can provide a ground state as a spin state of spins. This works because these are spins now. And the other thing is you have to be able to estimate energy sufficiently, but you can estimate the energy of this term efficiently. It's a many-body operator, but it's a very simple many-body operator.
No, but in the definition of the QMA complete problem above, you have a promise that there's only one state with energy less than A, is that right?
No. The question is just, is there, are there, well, the question is, does a ground state have the energy below some value? But of course, no one forces you to provide a ground state as a proof. As long as you provide some state which has energy below you, of course, the ground state will also have energy below.
And so that bounds the energy of the ground state.
Yes. So you don't have the state. Of course, I mean, no one forces a prover to give you either the ground state as a proof if some other state will also be the ground state. Okay, so the point that it's in QMA is not so hard. So the other thing is to show that it's hard for QMA. And the point of this done is to show that. Okay, this is used, this is used. So what we have to do is to show that a problem which is known to be QMA hard, and kept with a notion, because actually for physicists like me it's very puzzling. For computer scientists it's also puzzling, I guess, for physicists too. We have to show that a known hard problem can be reduced to the Hubbard Hamiltonian. Which means that, well, so the sense of reduced here is like I have this hard problem, I'm trying to solve it, and I just can't manage. But I have some very smart way to solve the Hubbard Hamiltonian. So I'm thinking, I have this problem, can I reduce the problem of solving this problem to solve the Hubbard Hamiltonian? Typically, actually, physicists would think the other way around. Like, I have the Hubbard Hamiltonian. Is it hard? Then, well, if it's hard, couldn't we then somehow embed a hard problem into it as like a special case? Like, if this contains as a special case a problem which is already hard, it clearly also has to be hard. And, well, there are two ways to think of it. And recently I switched the direction of thinking of it, but I still get confused myself. Some point is missing. Okay, so the thing is that the known QMI hard problem we look at is the following. We have a 2D lattice with the following Hamiltonian. So again, sum of the nearest neighbors. And then we have couplings of this form. Aij, Bij, where A, B, are Pauli matrices. So along each edge of the 2D lattice, we have a coupling, so it's a qubit lattice. We have a coupling, which is a product of Pauli's. So simply just a product of Pauli's. So we have this lattice. We have like x times x here, and x times z here, and minus x times y here, and so on. Something like that. And we want to show that actually, again, the physicist language, this arises in a special case from the Hubbard model. And what we do for that is we use what is called perturbation gadgets. So the idea is somehow that, well, you want to encode any product of Pauli interactions. But in fact, you just have some tunneling and actually don't even have qubits. But what you do is try to, okay. How to express that. Okay, let's forget about the Hubbard model and electrons. Let's just think about spins. You have some quite special spin Hamiltonian given, say a Heisenberg coupling, and you want to realize any product of Pauli with any strength. So what could you do? What you do is something like that. So that's what we do. One can do more involved constructions. Let's say we have a Heisenberg coupling, sigma dot sigma. Then we take the central qubit and we impose a strong local field, B, on the central spin. And then we look at this as a perturbation expansion. So we have a Hamiltonian, which is a magnetic field coupling to the central spin, plus, well, this Heisenberg Hamiltonian here, say, which actually is very weak compared to the strong central field. So it can be considered a perturbation. And so what you get effectively is the following, that, well, if you do a low energy expansion, so perturbation theory, what you find is that this spin is essentially decoupled. So So it's in its ground state. And but what you get is in physics terms virtual processes where some excitations can hop around here. And what will happen is that in first order this cannot happen because after the end of this hopping process you have to be in the ground state of the strong field again. But what can happen is that second order processes occur where either some excitation hops like that and hops back, or it hops here and it hops to the other side. And this way you will get some kind of effective coupling between this guy and that guy in the low energy sector of the Hamiltonian. We look at the ground state energy, so we're happy with the low energy sector. And this one might actually depend on the way we do our perturbation, and also maybe as a structure of this graph, it might take more complicated graphs. So we might be able to engineer and design interactions from a given fixed special interaction. And that's actually what we're going to do, to go from the Hubbard Hamiltonian to that, to this known QMA half Hamiltonian.
So the effective coupling here is going to be given by the polyhedral operators along the direction of the hill?
No. Well, actually, we need this one so we can go through this one intuitive. This one is fairly intuitive. Some of those we need are less intuitive because they have like fields in strange directions and things like that. So this is fairly intuitive because what we have is, let's say, the field is along the z direction, okay? And well, the Hamiltonian. It's xx plus yy plus dz. So what is the intuition of that? It means that you can have a process like an x. Let's look at this one. You can have an x operator acting here, and an x operator acting here, or y here and y here, or z and z. So let's first look what happens if you have z and z. Well, if you have that, this doesn't change the state of this guy here. This just gives a phase to this z polarized state. But if you do perturbation, you want that you go into an excited state in your virtual processes. Otherwise, it's not allowed. So this one will actually cancel out because it cannot excite this strongly polarized middle state. So that's why we're going with this guy. And if you consider what this guy does, actually the easiest way to see is that this guy is just a hopping Hamiltonian in the subspace with one spin up. So in the subspace 0, 1, 1, 0. So what you have is that if you have one excitation here, right, you can't have one here, this is in the ground state. The excitation can hop here, and it can hop back. This gives kind of a randomization of the local energy. Or it hops through. So actually what you end up with is this Hamiltonian. So actually this is indeed part of what we need. Let's have a structure with a blackboard.
There's one behind
there. Yeah, no. I thought of using that one behind later again. This is more for the overview. So somewhere here, indeed, we will end up with Hamiltonians of the form xx plus yy and similar ones on a lattice. And what I told you now is essentially that from this one, you can go to a Heisenberg Hamiltonian. Well, our aim is to end up with a Hubbard Hamiltonian. So actually, one can do more gadgets of this type. So let's say from some mysterious reason you know that, well, somewhere we will get to a Heisenberg Hamiltonian. So we want to close the gap between arbitrary products of Pauli's and the Heisenberg Hamiltonian. So actually, the thing.
Sorry, remember, didn't you show that we can take the Heisenberg Hamiltonian and get this xx plus yy?
Yes, but conversely, it means that if you have some problem which has xx plus yy couplings, you can reduce it to something which has Heisenberg couplings.
Yeah.
So that's a problem. The physicist's intuition. So this is a computer scientist's arrow, and we can also put physicist's arrow. It's indeed a bit confusing, but actually, if you want to combine energy scales, I figured out that direction is indeed easier to access. But I mean, the physics situation is indeed you have this Heisenberg Hamiltonian, and you want to see, okay, I have this Hamiltonian where I have like, so this is more general than this one somehow, because I can also have xx plus zz or yy plus zz. They all look the same way. I mean, otherwise, it wouldn't be more general, but somehow the class gets more general. There are more different types of interactions. And again, so the computer scientist would ask, okay, can I reduce solving this problem with all these different kinds of interactions to just one type of interaction? Yes, you can. Oh, it's like the speech yesterday. Okay, and the other thing is that so the physics perspective would really be to say I have this Heisenberg chemical can I embed this class of chemicals more into it as a special case. But this is really just two ways to look at the same thing. Okay, so the next thing is that exactly the same spirit, what we can do is you can take xx plus yy here and xx plus yy here and put a field in y direction. And the argument is very much the same as before. I have this xx plus yy. So you can either have an x operator acting here and here or y here and here. But because the field is along the y direction, the y operator will not excite that thing. So what remains is this x operator. And this x operator will indeed flip this field along this spin, which is polarized along the y direction. So what can happen is you get an x here and an x here, and you can get a second x here. So you can just get an identity. Or indeed, this x excitation will hop here. So what you end up with is an x times x coupling. So Isaac.
So a question. I mean, if you put bz and then by, that's like putting a bzy, something along the zy plane.
Sorry?
If you put the field along b, along z, and then you put a field along y, that is like putting a field along something.
Wait. I mean this you have to think of sequentially. So the way to think of is like, how do I get this Isaac coupling? So let's say I want an Isaac coupling. X times X. Now this I can get by inserting an extra sentence in, putting this Y, let's say this is
Y. You're replacing this into spin.
And now again you do the same embedding.
Sure, yeah, okay, that's okay.
So you have a Y and two Z fields, which are actually of different strength, because these ones should again be a perturbation for this Y field. So you have to be careful, it's a field strength.
And then you get very strong fitting.
But you have to nest that. So. I mean that's clearly what has to happen if you want to embed some class of Prams in the Heisenberg Hamiltonian. Well, you have to embed it somehow, so you have to remove some spins, things like that.
So from here, you can go, depending on your favorite direction, to the class of Ising Hamiltonians.
And now comes the less intuitive part, which is that you can take one Ising Hamiltonian and a different Ising Hamiltonian, and then put a field in x plus y direction, or in some angle along the x times y direction. And what you get is something like an x tensor y coupling, with actually some lambda, which will depend on the angle in the xy plane. So you could just choose xy plane with some angle phi. Actually, that's not yet the Pauli case, because for the Pauli case, you also have to be able to create the Ising interaction again. And this works if you put the same Ising here and here, but you won't be able to get an antiferromagnetic coupling at that stage. So in fact, in order to get Ising, you have to take these Pauli guys and combine two of them again in the same spirit, again with some angle, so you can have a negative sign for an Ising coupling. It's a bit tricky with you. So the point of the Ising coupling would be that you already have the Ising coupling, but only with a positive sign. That's because of the perturbation. Sorry, it's a negative sign. So in fact, I've been cheating a bit, and all these couplings should be ferromagnetic, because second-order perturbation theory always gives you a minus sign. So all these guys should have minus signs. So in the end, to get an antiferromagnetic plus sign Ising coupling, what you will have to do is put something like x times y, z times x, and put some field with some angle in the y-z plane, because depending on the angle, you can get a positive or a negative sign. That's more like the technical issue. So what you see is that you get a Heisenberg Hamiltonian, but not really in a 2D lattice. You get a very sparse lattice. You get a lattice like
whatever. That's not counted. But you have these spins, which effectively, after putting the strong fields, will produce your 2D lattice with Pauli couplings. And in between, you have 15 more spins, so you have 16 couplings. So probably you can reduce them by going to higher order perturbation theory, but you still have many couplings. So now you would like to go to a 2D lattice. So you would like to go to a real 2D lattice. So what you do is you take all these other spins in the Heisenberg model and put a very, very, very strong field, much stronger than the fields before, so that you don't even have to care about second order perturbation theory. And this means they completely decouple, because the lowest order where you get coupling is like a second order curve. Excitation hopping, because it's been hopping back. So this is a sparse Heisenberg Hamiltonian. Well, and the last step in the Hubbard model is, well, what you do is you have this lattice with some tunneling and some on-site propulsion. You choose the tunneling to be much smaller than the on-site propulsion, which means that you have exactly one electron per side if you choose a number of electrons properly. So you have exactly one electron per side, and the spin degree of freedom of the electron indeed encodes the spin. And what happens again is a second order perturbation process where one of these guys hops here, and what it has to hop back, because it has to get to the ground state, which is one electron per side again. But this can only happen if these guys are in a singlet state, which means that the energy of the singlet state will be decreased, which is the Heisenberg Hamiltonian. This is starting okay, so that's the whole construction. So you see, you do a whole chain of such gadget constructions, each of which is quite elementary, and it shows that effectively you can obtain this 2D Pauli lattice Hamiltonian as a special case of the Hubbard model. Or conversely, you can reduce that guy to the solving the Hubbard model, which shows because solving this guy's QMA hard, also shows that applying the energy of this guy's QMA hard. And the arrays of polynomials, the arrays of a polynomial size, because the array is a third order or fourth order, whatever perturbation theory. And this is polynomially suppressed with respect to what you have here. And indeed, it turns out you can't use the scale such that it is polynomially small, as required. Okay, so this is one part of the proof. I will try to go through the second part quickly. Okay, so this is that part. So for the other part, it's kind of, you need to see how to derive the Hubbard model from a system of interacting electrons. And actually, this gets kind of technical. But so I'm just trying to sketch it very simply. So the way to do it is you want to... So the idea is that... Okay, where's our Hamiltonian? You take the Hamiltonian above, and you first omit the Coulomb repulsion. And then you say, well, in the end, we try to put the Coulomb repulsion as a kind of perturbation in our system. So we would like to do some perturbation expansion. But the problem is the Coulomb is not bounded. So you cannot do standard perturbation theory in a rigorous fashion. So you have to be more careful in that case. And actually, what turns out what you can do is you can come up with a lattice model where you have a lattice potential without the Coulomb term, where the system is exactly solvable. So you know a lot of properties of the system. So the idea is to take some kind of Fermi Penny model where you have delta-like potentials in 1D. And in 1D, you can solve this model, and you find that when your state is localized, your eigenstates in the lowest band are localized states around one of these potentials. And you can indeed compute, like, get the gap of that system and how these states look like with a high accuracy. And then you build a 3D system, which is just... a sum of three 1D potentials, which means that you again can solve this model because the solutions are just the products of the solutions of the 1D models. But it means again you know how the ground state subspace, how the wave function of the low energy subspace looks like, and you particularly know the gap. And knowing this gap, which is very large, you can indeed bound the effect of the Coulomb repulsion. So if you add the Coulomb repulsion, it will kind of tend to tunnel to highly excited bands. But the gap is large enough, and the kinetic energy in this high band is high enough such that it gives a low contribution. I think I will. Okay. I don't have like 5 minutes, I guess.
Yeah, you have a few more minutes. Yeah.
Okay, so I guess I will not talk much about how to really derive, but you can really do it, and you can show that that the Hubbard mod arrives at a special case of a system of interacting electrons, and you can divide a set of basis functions, namely exactly these localized functions of the Swan-D model, multiplied in three dimensions, which span the subspace in which you can solve the Hubbard model to a very high accuracy. So to know this function is actually important, because if you want to use density function theory to solve the problem, you need to do two things. First, you need this potential you have for the Hubbard model. But the potential we have, but you also need to be able to devise a relatively small subspace for the density slow of R in which you try to solve this problem, because otherwise it's just a continuous function, so it's not really clear whether you can solve something efficiently or even in whatever complexity class, because it's not discretized, it's just fully continuous. But the thing is, you can, so let's call these 3D guys W, I of R, like value functions. And so we try to solve the subspace spanned by these guys. So we have a spin and we have a spatial density. And these lambda coefficients determine a subspace in which we know that we can very well approximate the ground state of this model, which again approximates the Hubbard model. So we know we get close to the ground state energy if we apply DFT just in the subspace. And well, this is like 4 NP parameters or something like that. That's one thing, and I'm running out of black holes.
The one in the back, I think you saw it.
Oh, that's not that one. Okay. So that's the first thing to observe. The second thing to observe is that actually this function f of rho is a convex function, at least in the way it's defined. It really is a convex function because, well, if you have a mixture of two densities, you can as well take the mixture of the global states, and this gives you an upper bound on the function on this mixture. So it means that, in particular, the energy for a given density, which is f of rho plus phase potential times rho, is also convex. And well, the set of allowed lambdas, well, because it's a state, should also be convex. So you have a quite low dimensional space, which is convex, a convex set, and you want to minimize the convex function up to some accuracy. And you have this black box, which computes this function, also up to some polynomial accuracy. And it turns out this is a minimization talk which can be carried out efficiently. Okay, so that's essentially the result. This can be done efficiently. So what we have is that the Hubbard model is QMA complete, and the Hubbard model with some polynomial accuracy approximation of the functional is in P. So and this implies that, well, as you want to phrase it, if you can compute this function, QMA will collapse to P. Or, well, computing this function is a QMA hard task. Well, at least under poly reductions. Yes, so this effectively tells you that, well, there are very, very fundamental bonds, at least if you believe in some separation between QMA and P, which I guess everyone does, that there are the fundamental bounds in your ability to approximate this functional f beyond a certain accuracy. So it doesn't mean it's not applicable in practice. In practice, you will typically aim for lower accuracies. But it still tells you that there are fundamental limitations to the thing. And you shouldn't try to come up with a universally applicable and high accuracy approximation of this function. I think I will stop here. Thanks.
Any questions?
Yeah.
So, as far as I know, condensed matter physicists don't tend to think in terms of complexity class.
I know.
But would it be fair to say that there was a misconception that perhaps the density functional theory could be done, that it was just sort of a lack of cleverness? I mean, will the condensed matter physicists be surprised to see this?
I guess some would, some not. I think that often they don't have a coherent opinion on whether this function can be found or not. I guess in the initial times of DFT, many people thought they really could find this function. If they just thought hard enough, they would come up with a function and everything would be solved. I think now it's more split. I think a couple of those guys still believe one could find this function in principle. It's just extremely hard, like proving Fermat's theorem or whatever. And I think others believe it cannot be found. I mean, this shows it cannot be found, except you don't believe in the separation between P and Q and A.
So do condensed matter physicists care about the model where B fields change from site to site, or are they interested? It seems like
people in DFT certainly look at this variant of DFT where you have a magnetic field, so where you have a spin degree of freedom, which couples the spins.
Okay.
So people do that. I mean, the question is, of course, how quickly will this magnetic field vary and how large will it be? I mean, here we do perturbation catch, so we need very large fields, and probably in practice the fields will be much lower. Again, I think in practice the method works very well, and it's probably the best method people have for many, many problems. So it doesn't say that what people did was wrong. It just tells you that there's some kind of limitations, and you shouldn't look for certain things. You should look for more restrictive.
That's the term of the case.
So I didn't quite follow your final conclusion. What in you're saying? Don't try to come up with a high accuracy approximation of f, but a low accuracy one is possible. Now, can you be a bit more specific? What do you mean by high and low accuracy?
So what we have is that we need some. What we have is that if you have an approximation which is more accurate than some polynomial in N, then you get problems because you can't solve this QMA problems in P. Now, this polynomial scales pretty badly, but that's probably partly because we just use a very straightforward simplification construction. I would guess you can improve this polynomial considerably. I don't know how much. So certainly, if your accuracy is... So if instead of that, you take like a constant accuracy, or actually what people in solid state physics might often do, just an extensive constant accuracy. So I mean, if you only look at intensive quantities, this means you get a fixed accuracy in intensive quantities, more or less. If you look at this, probably you should be able to do it much, much more easily. Although it's not completely clear, because I guess it should be connected to these questions around the quantum PCP theorem and things like that, which is like, you know, it's QMA hard to compute the ground state energy up to a polynomial accuracy, but how hard is it to compute it up to some constant fixed epsilon accuracy? Is this equally hard or not? And this question is not settled, but some people believe it's the QMA hard, I think. It might be related, but it's an interesting question indeed, whether this might be an easier task, but it might be done by a quantum computer or whatever.
Other questions? If not, let's thank over again.